Thank you for tuning in to Talking Bay 94, the Star Wars podcast devoted to interviews with the cast, crew, and creators of A Galaxy Far, Far Away. I'm your host, Brandon Winerdy, and today is my conversation with prequel concept artist Warren Fu, live from South by Southwest 2024. We dive into Warren's incredible contributions to these movies, including Magna Guards, Vector Ships, and, of course, General Grievous. From there, we take a deep dive into his wildly prolific music video career, and especially his work with Daft Punk. This is Talking Bay 94, episode 159, Warren Fu. Star Wars, what initially sparked that creativity for you? What was kind of inspiring you at a young age?
First inspiration was probably my mother. She's not really an artist, but she would just like doodle on the phone and just like draw dress patterns while she was on the phone. I thought she was like the most amazing artist, even though she doesn't really draw anymore. Like I was like in love with Spider-Man or Snoopy, and then she would just show me how to draw and I would just be completely blown away by my mother. And then my aunt got me a Norman Rockwell, because I started to get into cartoons and drawing, and every first page of my childhood books, the blank page, would have Spider-Man drawn on it. So my aunt got me a Norman Rockwell book, and I was just completely blown away, especially by this particular painting called The Gossip. And it's an oil painting, but it's sequential. It tells a story within that. So that's what I really loved about that particular painting, is that just through the facial expressions, you could see a story happening. So I think that was sort of like the, now that I think about it, sort of the lead into like storytelling with art. And then I guess the next step was this show called Battle of the Planets. In Japan, it's called Gatchaman. And it was a late 60s show, probably inspired by Star Wars, actually. A lot of the titles were kind of similar to it, but the design of it was so amazing and sleek, and then that sort of started off my obsession with sort of Japanese design. Sure. And then there was a show called Robotech, which in Japan was called Macross, and also probably inspired by Star Wars as well, but was into that sort of, it was sort of a more mature version of Transformers. And I drew that obsessively, and you could probably see a lot of it in my design work with the General Grievous full body. And I did this like clone trooper, sky trooper design that was probably heavily inspired by Macross and Gatchaman. And then I got into graffiti art, and that was this whole other direction of inspiration. It was interesting because, like, I think a lot of my childhood was copying stuff. Just whatever I liked, I would recreate the scene. You know, I recreated the Hoth battle. I just redrew it. And then I think graffiti was the thing where they encouraged you to just sort of be creative and how original you could be. And so there was this graffiti artist named Slick, and he was, I think he was from Hawaii, but he lived in L.A., and his graffiti art just completely, like, blew my mind. It was so creative and surreal and organic, and it would just twist and turn in certain ways. So, yeah, I think that was sort of this opening door kind of mind-opening, mind-altering moment, just seeing his artwork. That's probably inspired by that Star Wars cover over there.
That's funny.
It's interesting then, because you go to college and you don't study art. And what, was it just like,
I wanted
to have a career, you need to be...
Like it's interesting, because I had, my parents bought my older brother the Art of Star Wars sketchbooks. Obsessed with Joe Johnson, by the way, and the fact that he did Iron Giant too. Like,
isn't it crazy?
Amazing. Very traditional Taiwanese parents that were not, they didn't really encourage the art thing. I said I wanted to do, like, I wanted to do maybe transportation design, or I wanted to go to Art Center or maybe Cal Arts, but they were like, no, you're going to go study something more practical at Berkeley. So, you know, I go to Berkeley, and I don't know what I want to major in. Maybe I'll do marketing or something. And then I took all these business classes and I got into the minor of business at Berkeley, but I didn't get into the business program. So I basically, with all these prerequisites, I got sort of, my only option was economics. So I graduated with economics. And my final year, I was thinking, I was like, what am I going to do? I don't want to work at a stock brokerage. Sure. It's just not me. I respect people that could do it, but I can't, right. It's not me. And I ran into a childhood friend who had known me since fourth grade. And she's like, you're supposed to be an artist. I don't know why you're at right. this career center day, like looking at consulting firms.
Right.
She's like, go to the career center. I saw an application for Lucasfilm. Go do that. And I went there and the application was past the deadline.
Mm-hmm.
And it said you needed to have a sponsorship from an art teacher or an architecture teacher. And so I begged this architecture teacher that I've, even though I wasn't an architecture major, I just asked somebody to help
right.
sponsor me.
Yeah.
And I had a friend that worked at a record label, and we backdated my application. he had a post office machine that we could like change the date, and then I made it look like it was it had gone through. It got lost in the mail, so I put these like tire tracks on it and everything, and then submitted it, and then I got in.
And that was just you were just an intern.
I was an intern at Lucasfilm. So I was making copies, cleaning monitors, and. I think, what was I working on at the time? It was Men in Black.
Okay.
And this is they were working on Men in Black, and then, like, anytime, like, I could get a peek at the prequels, right. there'd be, like, a monitor with something on it, and I'd, like, sneak over and take a peek, and, you know, I would see some shots of Watto on a monitor. And, but yeah, that was really exciting, because, like, all the young interns, every time we saw a glimpse of Star Wars somewhere, right. we were like, oh, I want to work on it.
Right.
So yeah, it was interesting because like I was like doing research for other artists there, like Alex Yeager, who's still there working, and Derek Thompson, who's at Pixar in the story department. But they would need references for creatures or whatever, and there was a library in the art department where we would just like Derek would say, I need a reference of a bat wing illuminated from behind. Like backlit, so I could see the veins and stuff. I'm like, and I would just go through books and encyclopedias right. and try to find something, and I couldn't find something, so I went to the Berkeley Library because right. I was still a student, and I would look through all these books, and then I would just bring it back to Derek, and I'd say, is this it? And he's like, no, it's not backlit. So now, and then when Google Images right. arrived, I was like, oh my God, this is so much easier. Right. So yeah, it was such a strange time to be pre-internet, or like the beginnings of the internet before you could just Google Images.
Right. How did you, at the time, you're doing, not menial tasks, but you're doing work that is not necessarily artistic or not mm-hmm. necessarily creative. How did you then either show your creativity, mm-hmm. right? How did you make that known, right? That's a tough thing to do, especially as as an intern.
I gotta give a lot of props to, or thanks to David Nakabayashi. Yeah. He's still the creative director of the art department there. He was sort of like this big brother. He said... Because I was debating whether to put graffiti art in my portfolio, because I had a few just like oil paintings and portraits I had done, just very simple copying things, right. like I was saying, like I could copy really well. But then he said, yeah, I saw your portfolio, and yes, you can render something and copy a photo, but he said, your graffiti art is where I saw your creativity.
Mm.
So he always sort of believed in me, and he, you know, took me to dailies for the first time, and I sat behind George Lucas in the theater, and he would like whisper to me, he's like, there was a shot of Watto.
Right.
It was the first dailies I ever went to. And he would just say, okay, what are you seeing in this shot? I'm like, I don't know, it looks good to me. And he's like, well, point out what's wrong with it or what we need to fix.
Right.
I'm like, I don't know, the shoulder maybe? And then like, and so I didn't know how to like, really see, you know, the way an art director sees. And slowly over time, he kept bringing me to dailies, and I started to understand, you know, the language and what things to look out for. And so he would start throwing me little things. I was like making copies, and then he said, okay, I need a floor pattern for the Gungan boardroom.
Sure.
And So he's like, I need this done in a vector. I'm like, what's a vector? And he's like, I need it done in Illustrator. Right. And so he's like, trace these Art Nouveau shapes and we'll use it for the pattern. And I did it and he completely chewed me out in front of everybody. He's like, there's the, you know, dots everywhere. He's like, that's not how you do vectors. It's like how few lines you could, key points, keyframes you could do to and still make the curve look elegant. So it was sort of a tough love thing, but I really kind of got scared into and I started like staying up late. And then he would just keep giving me more things like, you know, Darth Maul needs a binoculars thing. And that was the first time a shot that I worked on got presented at dailies. Yeah. And then I was sitting behind George in the darkness and he approved that shot. And it's like, yes, that's crazy. I got a shot in Star Wars.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was just kind of step by step building up. And then Doug Chang.
I've heard of him.
Yes. he was a big inspiration as well, too. You know, here was this very similar upbringing to mine, I would say. Like, he's Taiwanese. He grew up in L.A. Yeah. He was an artist. And then I saw this, like, you know, Asian-American sort of person that was, like, leading.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was something I hadn't grown up seeing. Yeah. And so
and in a creative field.
In a creative field. And he led with such like calm respect, which I still try to, which I was inspired by. And I try to like remind myself to be like, so, and he always led by example. He worked so hard. He would draw himself. And so I feel like that sort of made other people respect him a lot. So I really liked the way that he worked, and it was always sort of this thing where, like, you know, everybody wanted to work on the pre-production side of things in the design department. Right. So, you know, practice, and submit to Doug and see if you get in.
Right.
Yeah, eventually, I think I'd worked on the Phantom Menace in the art department doing some display. I eventually moved on to, like, Pod Race display graphics, the... It's crazy, like, you know, I helped design the Naboo display screen, and then you watch The Mandalorian, like,
and they're still,
years later, and it's like, oh, shit, they're still using the same design.
The displays themselves, I talked to, they're called Blind Limited, they're a UK-based agency that now does all of the displays for Star Wars, and they do it for Batman, they do it for everything, that's what they do.
Yeah, they're outside of ILM.
They're outside of ILM, they're a contractor now because... That, I think, is maybe the most important thing to, like, feel like. There's a lot of things that feel like Star Wars or don't.
Yeah.
But the displays, I think, are, like, the unsung sort of, like, you know if it's Star Wars or not, right? Yeah. Like, you know if it's Star Trek, you know if it's Battlestar, you know whatever, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting that a lot of your early work was kind of, like, it's almost the foundation. Retro-future kind of.
Yeah, it was sort of emerging of, it was, I come to think of it, it was a great transition point because... I got very much into graphic design. So there was two graphic designers in the art department that would just, they would do like the crew gear, the t-shirts, the calendars, Mark Malabuyo and Catherine Otoshi. Okay. And Mark Malabuyo, so I had all these like kind of big brother mentors, like David Nakabayashi was you know the head art director. You know, Doug Chang was this like kind of god inspiration.
Right.
And then Mark Malabuyo was like this big brother. He was the first person that I became friends with because I was very nervous. I didn't know anybody. And then Mark Malabuyo was playing Gangstar hip hop, DJ Premier, and I was just like very nervously came up to him and like, DJ Premier, huh? Like, and he was like, hey, man, where are you from? And I was like, oh, you know, I'm from Berkeley. He's like, oh, yeah, I'm from Oakland. And we connected.
Right.
He's like, let me take you out to lunch. And he was this cool guy in his convertible. And he taught me so much about graphic design. I didn't even know what graphic design was. And I feel like a lot of my work coming from that has a very, it sort of taught me simplicity in forms and design. And there was stuff, I think George had said in some, maybe it was George that said it, but like silhouettes were very important in design. And if you look at the X-Wing or the TIE Fighter, whatever, very iconic shapes. And that all comes from, I think it's all, you know, there tends to be a separation when people talk about like industrial design or graphic design.
Right.
And I like the overlap. I feel like, why aren't more traditional artists, better graphic designers, it seems like there's this big separation. So I tend to like both, and I love doing... So I designed the Skywalker Sound logo.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was just... I was passing by one day, I overheard that they needed a logo, and I was like, Valkyrie jumping in front of the moon. And I just, like, sketched it, and I, like, slid it over.
Right.
And they're like, okay, we'll submit this, and it ended up being the logo. So... that I got paid nothing for, but
wait a second.
But but it was, you know, it was I was like under contract, so I was like, paid my usual salary. But I'm so honored that they chose the logo, because it's like Skywalker Sound is such, to this day, is like the place to be for sound design and scoring, you know, where they record everything. Right. So I love that world of design crossing over into concept art.
Right, and then I guess. Because with Attack of the Clones, it becomes a little bit more formalized. Like, how does your role change between those movies?
It's funny. South by Southwest was the first time I came was because I designed Doug Chang's website.
Okay.
I was trying to get in good with Doug.
Oh, for sure.
Of course. And so he had a project called Robota.
Yeah.
And I don't know how he knew I could do graphic design, but I don't know. Somehow we got in conversation. I designed his website, worked with a team of, like, coders.
Right.
And I think we won something at South by Southwest. This is so long ago now.
Right.
But that was the first time I came to South by Southwest because the Doug Chang website won an award.
Yeah.
Then, you know, came time for episode 2, and I submitted. I was like, okay, how do I get to that next level? And I would just look at the concept artists. Oh, here's what Ian McKaig's doing. Here's what Jay Schuster does. I need to do more, move out of this kind of 2D design world into like 3D industrial design. So I designed a few spaceships and I submitted it, and a few kind of concept art paintings. It's all about looking at these art of books and saying, does my work match that level?
Right.
And it doesn't. So I got to keep practicing. Right. So I finally got enough of a mini portfolio together to submit to Doug, and I had a short stint in the art department up at the ranch, and that was
crazy.
Like, to be, you know, the charm of ILM is really fun. You know, it's like we were in these warehouses in San Rafael, very kind of scrappy warehouses, cubicles, and then you go to Skywalker Ranch, and it's like, you know, Victorian, like woodwork, Norman Rockwell paintings.
Well, you mentioned that earlier. I mean, that's a big inspiration for George, right? George, like, that's like, he is, I think, the biggest collector of Norman Rockwell paintings in the world, him and Spielberg. And it's like how he views storytelling, right? He always is like, comic books and Norman Rockwell are like the American like, storytelling, like, history.
Yeah.
That's what he's doing in his museum, but that's why he collects that. It's a very...
Yeah, I never made that connection till now, like my aunt getting me that book and being inspired, and then going to the ranch and seeing Norman Rockwell paintings above the fireplace.
Right.
And that was the first time you could see, like, I've seen a painting up close, and then, like, you could look at the veins and the hands and, like, just the attention to detail. So, yeah, that was just an amazing experience, like, just being in the attic of Skywalker Ranch. I think it was Ian McKaig was there, Jay Schuster, Mark Gabbana, and Sid Mead came to visit, and Ralph McQuarrie came to visit. We have a group photo that I'm trying to find a frame for.
Right.
But it was just an amazing time. Mike Murnane, he was a sculptor there. Yeah, it was so much fun. Those that short little stint I did in episode 2. So it was starting to move into like some design stuff. And I think I came up to do some droids, background droids.
Yeah, I mean, well, they didn't end up being that background, huh? Because I do have, it's for Dexter Jetster, right? Jetster, and so this droid, for those who cannot see this book in front of me, it's the waitress droid from Dexter's Diner.
Yeah. Which is that one's mine too.
Then I think that is your, where is it? Something 5 is yours. Yeah. They say that's yours.
No, that one's not mine.
Okay.
They got to correct that.
We got to, we'll submit it to, we'll submit it to Delray.
Yeah, I think Dexter might have been Mike Murnane. He sculpted it.
The sculptor. Because, when I was doing research, I guess these maquettes would then be kilned in the Skywalker Ranch kitchen ovens. Is what it said in the book. And I was
amazing.
That's like next to the cookies. Like they're also putting these maquettes.
That's why the cookies tasted so weird.
Okay, well, I heard the cookies taste great.
I've heard
a rumor, because I was able to go to Skywalker Ranch last summer. And it is like the most
Beautiful.
Beautiful, magical, like creative. Like you're like, oh, like this is why this kind of work gets done, because you're able to surround yourself in this nature and this. But then I was told, I was like, because the food was good. And then I was like, they were like, you didn't get the cookies though.
Mm.
And apparently the cookies now are very good. So maybe they stopped making the maquettes.
Yeah.
All to be said though, this design ends up being Star Tours. It ends up like it has kind of carried through. Again, kind of like we'll talk about a lot of your designs, mm-hmm. whether used or not or background or not, have this intrinsic Star Wars DNA mm-hmm. that has carried through in a sense where people feel like it is intrinsically Star Wars, which I think is very interesting, very early in your career for it to be, you're already hitting at least something, you're tapping into something.
Yeah, I always gravitated towards, you know, because it was Joe Johnston's work was so ingrained in my head. And what I loved about Joe Johnston's work was how tactile and weighted and realistic it felt. It felt like all of his designs, it just feels like it would work in the real world. It's not doing anything like impossible in a way, like sometimes a CG creature in a movie or a CG thing, you know, does something that's not believable. Everything that Joe Johnston does design-wise feels like it would really work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came from that school of thought where I really wanted to kind of push towards that sort of weighted feel of what Joe did. And also, even though he's not a graphic designer, the silhouettes, the simplicity of, you know, the simple line across the AT-AT's eyes. So cool, you know, like just the details and the line work. Even though he's not a graphic designer, he would probably make an incredible graphic designer. It's just knowing, and I think that's what graphic design is a lot of times. It's streamlining ideas into something simple and iconic and powerful.
I wonder if that's because, at least initially for him, he didn't have computers, right? Mm-hmm. They weren't able to digitally render anything. And so it all had to be sculpted and formalized, right? And made into something that was practical.
Yeah.
Which again, I think speaks to the physicality of Star Wars too, mm-hmm. where it is, you know, you are, this Attack of the Clones is the first digital movie.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
But it does still have to feel weighted. It does still mm-hmm. have to feel real. And I think that's where a lot of these designs end up being so, you know, they stand the test of time in a sense, because they're not just, in a sense, digital renders.
Exactly, exactly. And there's something like, you know, when you see, like, let's say, like, movies that are super futuristic and touchscreen and holograms and like, you're not really physically touching something, I kind of lose interest. But the this is why the retrofuturism of Star Wars mm-hmm. is so fun, is because, like, you know, the display screens, the analog and digital, it's like, early tactile. Digital. Yeah, like, it's an LED screen that's, mm-hmm. like, you know, blinking on and off, and Han Solo's got like a physical, like, stick shift. Like tactile buttons and things are lighting up. So that's what makes it fun. I don't want to see, like, you know, I love Minority Report, but I don't want to see like people swiping in the air and stuff. It's just there's something more human about being able to touch and physically sit in things. It just makes it, makes you feel like you're really there,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Attack of the Clones to Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah.
That's a big jump then, right? Because then you are kind of the formalized, that's where a lot of people first heard about you, right? That's where you really became like part of the Star Wars DNA in a very real sense. Was able to work with that art department and be on Skywalker Ranch. And
yeah, yeah. So that was, you know, I think I was there right at the beginning.
Right.
For that film. And in between those, I had worked on, no, I worked on AI.
Yeah.
And that was sort of the big project I worked on in between. And that was it was interesting because, like, after on post on Attack of the Clones, I worked in as sort of like a junior art director for the VFX stuff. And it was great because I worked with the model shop. So Alex Yeager worked a lot on the kind of CG
mm-hmm.
art direction. And I was kind of more focused on working with the model shop, like Steve Gawley and those, Charlie Bailey.
Who were there since the early, early days.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And to this day, I'm here at South by Southwest hanging out with Trevor Tuttle, who was in the model shop, and Aaron Hay, who's a production designer now. So I became really good friends. I'm still good friends with Aaron Hay. So the model shop guys, I have this certain kind of connection and kinship with. I loved the whole vibe of the model shop, the guys that kind of build stuff, you know, physically. And so, so then I was up at Skywalker Ranch for episode 3, and Ian McCaig was there, and just a huge kind of magical inspiration. Like, just, he just like spits out gold nuggets of life altering philosophies. I remember that one of the first things he did was, you know, I could read signatures and figure out people's personalities. Why doesn't everybody just sign their names and I'll figure it out? And then I signed my name. He's like, huh, very interesting. You write all capital letters for your normal writing, and then you've got a very kind of showboaty kind of style to your... So it was like, so I see a certain kind of like balance. You've got a very practical side and a very kind of showboaty side to your signature. And I was like, oh, he's probably right. He is right. And yeah, and then he was just very big on like, I remember he was like, all right, everybody stop working. He's like, we need to rearrange the art department. Like, I don't think the feng shui or whatever is right. Yeah. So like, everybody get up, gather your things. Okay, maybe this desk should be here. And like, he rearranged the art department so that the energy and flow could
That's
be.
So funny.
So yeah, it was just great having that sort of like presence there. And I think he sort of was a good inspiration during the, you know, because he designed Darth Maul. And so when it came time for the Grievous thing, he was like kind of like coaching us and a great inspiration during that phase.
It's very interesting because, I mean, him and Doug Chang end up being sort of like the through line, especially for the prequels, right? But like really like kind of defining what 30 years before 1977 looks like, right? That is kind of a very tough thing. And then his work is fluid, right? It's very like compared.
Yeah.
It's almost like your signatures, right? It's very, it's compared to Doug Chang, right? Which is almost industrial.
Yes.
But beautiful, right? Like it's like car design almost.
It's like yin and yang. You needed both.
But then I think you slot in almost between them. I think the work that you do, especially, I mean, and we'll go through some of the stuff you did for Sith, but it is a little bit of that combination that I think works.
Yeah, like the Padme dress was very like, you know, I like drawing people. I'm not, it's funny because I could toil over things and finally get it right, but it was so, it's like the movie Amadeus when like Amadeus is just like naturally gifted and just like composes these songs. Right. Like Ian McKaig will just like hold a pencil in a weird way and start scribbling like this. And then it looks like the most perfect shaded face in scribble.
Right.
And it's like the Amadeus movie. It's a work of God.
Right.
and then here I am like erasing till you get things right. But yeah. So it's something like this, like it is toiled over until I get it right. And then I clean up and erase it and try to get it there. But,
although this is a lot more polished than some of your other pieces, I feel like, at least that are in the book too. Like you really did take the time to make it almost feel like
an Ian
McKay.
Yeah, I think this is the first time I did a dress.
Yeah.
You know, and so I wanted to get it right. And and you could kind of see some of the graphic design inspiration in the line work.
Right.
You know, so this is what I mean by like trying to merge the worlds of graphic design and fashion design and yeah, it's just I love all of it. And I loved, that was the thing that was so amazing about this job, is like 1 week I'm designing a spaceship and then the next week I'm doing a dress.
Right.
It's like incredible. And you know, George would come upstairs to the, he would write a little bit of the story, come up, look at drawings, and you could see the wheels churning.
Right.
He's like, okay, I'm going to go back down and write some more. So it was a very organic process, and I was like, I want that job. It's so cool. Yeah. He gets to, like, you know, be inspired by things and work on a story. But I was trying to steer him towards the Jaipur snippet.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, because I was like, you know what? Like, we know how tragic this thing ends up. And there was that random scene in Phantom Menace where he gives her like this Jaipur snippet, this little trinket. And I'm a sucker for like little things like that make you cry in movies. So I was like, oh, I want George to remember the Jaipur snippet.
Yeah.
And so like I drew it on there. And I usually tried to like, during our meetings, we post all the artwork on the foam core boards and he'd walk around. And I usually try to shut up and not interject anything. But I was like, oh, yeah. And so I kind of threw in the Jaipur snippet there. And he's like, yeah. Like, I see that. But then I like to think that was the moment where he's like, I'm going to put it in the movie.
Yeah.
And it was in the funeral scene.
Yeah.
So, and it's a powerful moment.
It is truly, it ties it all the way back.
Yeah.
I'm glad.
So I don't know if I should take credit for it, but tried to like.
No, because I noticed it. And it even says it in the caption too. Like, because you don't see it in any other art really until you get to the later funeral stuff. And so it is like. he doesn't remember that. I mean, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, he wasn't thinking about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, I think he was thinking about other big picture things. And
it moved into the front of his brain.
Yeah, yeah. And I think I remember telling Ian I was going to put it in there. He's like, oh, that's good.
Yeah. And Ian, the captain of Padme, really.
Like yeah, he's the one that, I think he's the one that recommended Natalie Portman to
the yes, role. Because yeah. of the face. Yeah, yeah. Like, that's what, yeah. Because I was able to interview him for Insider.
Okay, yeah.
And that was like very, I mean, because he's very.
It's funny because every time he drew women, before he even knew who Natalie Portman was, right. they kind of looked like Natalie right. Portman. So, of course, like, you know, this kind of classic. Right. Classic beauty of her face, like it made sense that right. you know he would say like the queen of Star Wars would look like that.
Right. Going back to the storytelling of Revenge of the Sith, because it's like all the prequels, and you're finally in that room, and you're able. He has the general sense, right? He we'll go through the lava planet in a second, but like he has this kind of like general idea of what mm-hmm. it could be. What are your design like? Choices. What are you being told to do every week or whatever it is to?
It would. He would just say, talk about what you know. We've got a new planet or something, and we need to work that out. Or there's a General Grievous is on a bridge of some kind of separatist ship right. or something. Or we need a fight scene. You know, like the fight scene that everybody even knew. That happened before we even, because like you know, Star Wars legend is like, oh, you know, Darth Vader
something
yeah. lava planet, and there was a big fight between Anakin and Obi-Wan, and we're like, holy shit, this is the week we're actually going to start working on it. And so what I was trying to push for in my few sketches for that week, maybe it was 2 weeks or something. I really like interactive stuff, like mm-hmm. where you're. This is what I loved about, you know, especially in a green screen world. Like, when you're starting to work in green screen, it tends to be, you can tell the actors don't know what they're doing sometimes because they're out in the open and they're not interacting with things. And I was like, I want to bring back that feeling of the interactiveness. Like, you look at the Cloud City fight, which was my favorite mm-hmm. of all those movies. He falls down the hole and then he hoses there. Yeah. He uses that. He jumps up and he's in the rafters. Right. Then he gets knocked through this glass thing and he's like swinging at these like pieces of junk that are flying at him. Like this is what makes it fun.
Right.
And so I was trying to think of like situations like that, like a monkey bar scene right, where they got to chase each other and there's like hot lava underneath them. And then in this one, I said, what if they were like they fall into this fan belt room where there's like something dangerous at the bottom and they keep sliding down the side of it and they're stuck in this close proximity.
Right.
And then there's like a hallway. I don't know if it made it into the book, but there's like a hallway shot.
There might be more.
That did end up using in the movie. I don't think it's in here.
Right.
But there's this corridor that I think I sketched that they did sort of something similar to it in the movie, but you know, I just wanted that corridor to feel tight and for there to be, like, you know, architecture that they could, like, swing and break, you know?
It's kinetic set pieces, really.
Yeah.
And because it's interesting because I feel like Spielberg is the master of that, right?
Yes.
And you do AI. And then also Pirates, I think, has that sensibility, too. I think that's the action, the adventure of kinetic storytelling and action is...
Yeah, that's what Spielberg's amazing at. You know, like Jurassic Park, where you've the tram or whatever's falling, and then you're on the glass hanging over a cliff, and you know that's the fun side of what Spielberg does well, and George did well too.
Yeah.
So I was trying to find inspiration in the art to kind of give George ideas for those types of scenes.
Yeah. Okay, we've danced around it a little bit, but we can talk about Magna Guards and Grievous now, I think. Now is the time.
Because
we brought up Maul. It is, again, very interesting to look at Star Wars and look at iconic villains, and that's like a big part. That's a huge part of Star Wars. And it's interesting going from Maul to Dooku, because Dooku is just Christopher Lee, right?
Yeah.
Christopher Lee, maybe the greatest villain of all time, right, in terms of acting. But you have the face, and you have the regalness, and then it's done. Like, that's pretty much what that... entails, but then you have Grievous, and it's very fluid, right? He doesn't really have a a reason, or he just is kind of like, we're going to have another bad guy, mm-hmm. right? How do you then start charting your path for that design?
I think it was, he came over and he said, 1 week, there's a new bad guy. And we're like secretly like, oh, wow, exciting. He's like, he's a droid general. And that can mean anything.
Yeah.
And we didn't ask. He just like, droid general, leader of the, you know, army. And just work on that this week. And George leaves. And then I think all of us had different interpretations. Does it mean droid general? Like he's a general that's a droid? Or does he mean general of the droids?
Right.
And so as you could see in the making of, everybody tried different things.
Right.
Like, you know, Derek drew a little boy.
Yeah.
And Ian drew these like very scary like things and kind of Medusa things. And I kind of went more of a, I guess, that sort of Joe Johnston school of thought, mm-hmm. where like cool helmets and cool masks right. are things that I love. And that's something if you look at the history of Star Wars, it's cool masks, like Boba Fett, even Princess Leia's mask when she's in the...
Boosh, yeah.
Yeah. So many cool shapes. And so I was like, I this is an opportunity for me to play around with that. So I was just sketching a whole bunch of little tiny thumbnails with our blue pencils, and I would just finally, when I had like a shape that I liked, I'd circle it and add a body.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny too, because like in the making of, they show me with a spray bottle, because I had an idea for one of the characters from a spray bottle, but that's one of the characters I got.
That's kind of like the.
Yeah, yeah. It's
no, in I the, think the photo is in here, and you can tell that it is a spray bottle.
Yeah,
but it's
exactly.
not. It's not. Where is it? But yeah, it doesn't end up being the.
It's not. Doesn't end up being
the
thing.
It was not part
of.
Yeah,
So those guys, I think subconsciously were inspired by the sand people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sand people have this like mouth guard
yeah.
thing. I tend to like things. I think things are scarier and cooler when you don't see the eyes or you can't tell what's going on. So these have hollow sockets. And
yeah.
I thought that was really creepy because that's kind of what I liked about Spider-Man mm-hmm. and Batman when I was a kid, was that they were expressionless.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was a little kid, when Michael Keaton's Batman came out, I was like, why are they showing his eyes?
Right.
I like the white eye.
Right.
So I would actually take white out on a printout of Michael Keaton's Batman and white out his eyes, because I like the kind of empty, expressionless thing where you can't read people. And so the Magna Guards were the first week, and you know, one of a few designs, the spray bottle thing, and then the mm-hmm. Magna Guards, and George was kind of hovering. I'm like, and then when the Magna Guard thing artwork was done, I was like, this feels like a thing. It feels like, this feels very Star Wars.
Right, yeah.
You know, and so when George like kind of passed by, I was like, damn it. And then he came back in, he's like, more in this direction.
Right.
I was like, cool. So he likes that. And so the next week, everybody's like doing more designs. And then Ryan Church sat next to me and he like called out to me. He's like, Warren, do you like alien eyes in the droid? So that was his idea. He's like, do something like alien eyes inside of the eyes or something. And I was like, okay. And so that was this.
Yeah.
So
it's like kind of bulging a little bit.
Yeah. And so it kind of looked a little maybe like subconsciously again, like Boba Fett. Now I'm realizing Boba Fett has some sort of like insignia that's like a...
Yeah, the skull.
The skull.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, it doesn't feel like Star Wars enough, so I'm going to put something on the ears.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, I always loved Jabba's skiff,
yeah.
how it has these like weird stabilizer things. So I'm just going to throw that on the ear. And it
That's
worked.
Crazy.
Yeah, and so George stamped it. And I wasn't very happy with this. I was like, it's okay, but feels too much like a, I don't know, like a praying mantis, like too insect-like. And I wanted it to be more Michael Myers from Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
And so Michael Myers from Halloween, terrifying, you know, like don't know what he's thinking, just hollow eyes, expressionless, and just walks very still through a scene and you're terrified. So that's what this was next. So I went from that to that, the straight on view.
Mm-hmm.
And as you could see, it's very Michael Myers. And one of my favorite movies was The Crow.
Mm-hmm.
And so I drew these
very randomly.
Yeah, Brandon Lee, pantomime eyes. And so, yeah, and Ian was like, what are the things that scare you? And so this was an amalgamation of Michael Myers, the Crow, and shrunken heads, how they've got like these stitched up mouths.
Yeah.
That always sort of, when I was a kid and I saw those photos of the stitched up mouths, they always kind of stuck in my head. And so that's what the mouth is. It's sort of like the stitching of shrunken heads. And it's how do you take all of these different, very different elements and combine it into one thing? And that's where the graphic design side of things come in. It's like streamlining it and refining it from this into something more elegant. And so I was too lazy to draw a body.
Right.
And I was like, so that's why this drawing was just a cape. And I was
truly, but that's elegant in itself, right? Like it doesn't. You're telling the story without it needing extra hours.
And that's why, like, Feng Zhu was in the art department. He had to design the body.
Yeah.
And he was, like, cursing me all the time. He's like, you just drew, like, these, like, shapes that looked good. But he's like, now I have to figure out how this thing is actually built and how it works. So he had to, like, draw all the, like, joints for this. And how does this thing rotate its hips if it's got this vertical line here? So, so the next week they're like, you got to figure out the body. And then I came up with this, and you could see this is very Japanese design inspired. Mm-hmm. This is very Gundam? Yep. I don't know how to pronounce it. Robotech type of design here. But I think in the end, Ryan, who is the art director, who's like, you know, it's cool, but we've seen this type of body a lot. It needs to be different. And so I think that's why they changed up the body and made it a little more organic skeletal. Yeah.
How much did you work on his transportation
as well? I had done a design sort of similar to this. I don't think it ever made the book. Oh, no.
No, that's you. That's, yeah.
Oh, that this is you. Me. Okay. Yeah.
Unless they're wrong again.
No, that is right.
Yeah.
I totally forgot. It's so weird seeing these things like many, 20 years later.
Yeah.
That was, again.
Because it's a reinterpretation of that design, I feel like. But as a vehicle, which is, I think, why that final design works so well, right? You're like, yes, that makes sense that is his ship, you know?
But it didn't walk in the end of the movie, right? Like, it didn't...
I think it had legs.
Okay.
I don't know. I'd have to watch the movie again. Maybe I've never seen Star Wars.
Yeah. No, but I don't think it walked. I think it just rolled around. But you could see a lot of Joe Johnston influence here. But yeah, this was sort of an extension. You could tell I designed this one because it looks like an extension of that of that previous.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that was there.
So, yeah, you're a little bit of a hero of this book. Yeah, that's why I think that's pretty much the only other thing was.
Oh, that's the corridor.
There we go. Look at that.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. See, that's why I put that there. That's at least anything else from Revenge of the Sith that you that sticks out to you? Because again, that's kind of a very interesting learning experience. I think you've compared it in previous interviews to a film school, right? Mm-hmm. And kind of having that, and we'll dive into the work you've done since Star Wars, obviously, which is like incredibly iconic in its own right, like truly insane. But how, like, because obviously business and economics at Berkeley, and then Daft Punk, like there is this gap.
Where
Skywalker Ranch is and Lucasfilm is, right?
Yeah.
And it has to be formative in some respect, in a lot of respect.
Yeah, it was just this transition into music, because directing is sort of... if you look at directors, they've all come from different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. There's directors that were actors first. There are directors that were cinematographers first. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm a director that came from an art background. And so there's a certain, like, affinity towards... I sort of am inspired by directors with that kind of background. Because if you look at... James Cameron can storyboard, Ridley Scott can storyboard, and they design stuff too. So, you know, I'm in no way in their league at all, but I'm inspired by that sort of school of thought of storytelling, sequential storytelling through storyboards and plotting things out in that way before you shoot. So I think the transition really came from, I was doing graphic design on the side.
Mm-hmm.
I was a big fan of music and a singer named Aaliyah,
mm-hmm.
who unfortunately passed away in 2001. But while I was at Lucasfilm, I started, I met her and her dad backstage at a KMEL Summer Jam. It's this Bay Area concert. I was like, I'm a graphic designer. Here's my business card. And you know, the father reached out to me. I showed him some of my work. He liked it, and I, you know, developed a relationship with them. And then they asked me to be the art director of her album. Mm-hmm. And then so I did the graphic design. I sort of did a logo and chose the photo for the album cover. I met up with the team, and her uncle happened to be a big fan of Gatchaman, mm-hmm. the Battle of the Planets. He's like, hey, do you? Not her uncle, her cousin, mm-hmm. who was part of the management team. He's like, you remember that show, Battle of the Planets? Like, yes. I was like, he's like, yeah. And he like jumped into the pose, like the landing, yeah. the ninja pose. And I was like, yes, that's my shit. And he's like, do you know anyone that could draw her in that anime style? I was like, I'll do it. And then I drew it. And then I think she was on a video shoot, and they had me show it to her. And she was like, oh my God, that's hot to death. She's like, this is so cool. And then approved by Aaliyah. And then her cousin was like, you know, it'd be cool if the album promo, we did a commercial in this style. Do you know anybody that could do it? I was like, yeah, I could direct that.
yeah.
And then I, you know, fake it till you make it sure. situation. And then I go back to ILM the next morning, and I, David Nakabayashi, my sort of big brother mentor, I'm like, I think I got a directing gig. I don't know what to do. What do I do? And like, I think I've got myself in trouble. What do I? And then he's like, dude, you'll be fine. You need a producer. We'll find you. He's like, I know, Alex L. Trocky is a great producer. She can do animation. There's a studio called Wild Brain in San Francisco, and they teamed me up with a most amazing art director there named Robert Valley. And Robert Valley is one of the all-time greats. He's done work with the Gorillaz,
right.
and you know, that famous Beatles rock band thing. And he's amazing. And so I got to work with him on this commercial, and the commercial aired on MTV. All my college friends gathered in my tiny apartment in Emeryville. Mm-hmm. And we all watched it, and there was just this rush of, like, you know, I had been working on, you know, Star Wars and these big budget things,
right.
and a small part in a giant production. And then here was this, like, tiny commercial, 30-second commercial that I had full
it was yours.
Sort of vision over. And that was the directing bug for me. And so when I eventually left Lucasfilm, I decided I want to do music videos. I love music so much, and so I'm going to start pitching cold turkey to bands. And me and Aaron Hay pitched something to Weezer,
right?
And we never heard back.
Uh-huh.
And then on my own, I was a huge fan of The Strokes,
right?
And something aesthetically resonated with me with their work. I was like, here's this band. I didn't even listen to like punk music or anything growing up, but something about their aesthetic was like, oh my God, what is it about their everything, their packaging, their artwork, the way they dress, the music just kind of feels like this universe. It's like world building. It was like they transported the 70s, 80s into the early 2000s. And so the song called You Only Live Once completely resonated with me. And I was like, wow, it sounds like it's a mixture of Queen, but there's like this, like these chords that are just so powerful. And I could see this, like, you know, the chorus is just so harmonic in the way that the bass, the guitar, the vocals, everything just fits together like a puzzle. And I pictured this like graphic equalizer, like a futuristic graphic equalizer in a circle with all the instruments. So I wrote out the notes, because I used to play piano as a kid. I wrote out the notes and kind of played the notes in this circular form, and the bass guitar like plays the chords, and then the guitar is another ring. So that was the idea for the chorus, and then I was like, okay, let's build this concept around it. So I came up with this whole idea and treatment for it, basically, and I didn't even know they were called treatments. And I was like, how do I get this to the Strokes? And I Google them. It's like, Strokes, they're under RCA. they've got a management in New York, and here's their address. And I just like put a FedEx package together. Mm-hmm. Because at ILM, they had a commercial department, so we would do presentations. Yeah. Right? And we'd mail stuff out on presentations. So I knew how to make a good-looking presentation. Right. So I made two FedEx boxes, submitted one to RCA, submitted one to WizKid Management. RCA responds via email, and they're like, who are you?
Yeah.
And what's your production company? And right. I was like, what's a production company?
Right.
And he's like, we're not even going to open this because, like, legally we can't even, like, look, get submissions from rando, you know, kids. So luckily, Julian Casablancas' assistant manager at the time opened it and looked at the artwork and said, this is great. Showed it to Julian. And then I get a call from Julian, and he's on tour in Paris or in France or something. He's like, dude, the fuck is this shit, man? He's like, this is so, he's like, we've been looking for someone like you for forever. I was like, okay, cool. And then it was like this kind of kinship and brotherhood that kind of formed out of that. Like when we first met each other, I was like, what's your favorite car? Dodge Charger 70s? Yeah, like, yeah, me too. And like, I love sunken living rooms in the 70s. Me too. Yeah. You know, like, so we had this like, you know, love of design and aesthetic that sort of carried on in some of our work. And the sort of the same sense of humor, like this kitschiness, like our first video we did together, we were just kind of like laughing about like certain, we still to this day like send each other memes and laugh about like RoboCop or Ghostbusters type things, but, or Karate Kid, you know, just cheesy 80s things we kind of love and also make fun of. Right. So that was sort of our bond. And I did a video independently with Julian, and then I did a video for Little Joy, an amazing band that the drummer of the Strokes asked me to do. Really low budget, like under 10K.
Yeah.
That was enough to get the attention of Partisan UK. There was a rep named Sasha Nixon, and she saw my work, and she's like, well, you just did something for Julian Casablancas of the Strokes? I was like, yeah. She's like, are you signed? I was like, no. And she's like, let me get you on the phone with Mark Ronson.
Yeah.
Are you available to talk to Mark Ronson today? And I was like, yeah. So she's friends with Mark Ronson.
Right.
So she gets me on the phone with Mark. Mark, they send me the song. I come up with an idea. I just kind of like come up with this idea for Bang, Bang, Bang. And it's like with Q-Tip from Tribe Called Quest and MNDR, another artist. And I was like, oh my God, Q-Tip. This is like so me. I like grew up with listening to Tribe Called Quest. Come up with this kind of bonkers idea about this alternate universe where the Japanese guy is speaking French and Mark is speaking Japanese, and it's like a weird talk show that turns into like a Gotcha Man intro where Mark transforms into this superhero by holding the watch over his eye, which is a very Battle of the Planets thing. And then he transforms into this super kind of musician in the video. And that was sort of, oh, and it's funny too, because like after Mark said, I love this idea, let's make it, then Sasha Nixon said, so, Mark likes the idea. And I was also being approached by Ridley Scott's production company. And I talked to Nock, David Nakabayashi, I'm like, Ridley Scott's company is asking me to join and Partisan. Nock said, well, didn't Partisan just get you a job? I was like, yeah. He's like, go with that. I was like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
And also, I got to give credit to Georges Berman, who's the guy that founded Partisan with Michel Gondry. He sent me a personal email saying, I've looked at all your work and I've seen your artwork and I feel like you fit the DNA of Partisan really well. So that it's that nice personal touch that got me on board. So, yeah, we did this Mark Ronson video, and it's this kind of retro-futuristic thing with, you know, Ghostbusters-style optical effects that I was trying to fake. And, I noticed all those inconsistencies and imperfections that made the old Tron and Ghostbusters effects look really interesting and organic because they were drawn by hand and photographed optically. So I faked it, you know. And next thing I know, the U.S. office of Partisan said, Daft Punk wants to meet you.
Sure.
I was like, what? Yeah, at their office. I'm like, wow, aren't those guys like robots or something? Right. And then, you know, I go to the office and meet two very just normal looking French guys.
You weren't blindfolded? Or
no, just a regular office at, you know, amazing office in the middle of Jim Henson Studios, which used to be A&M Records.
Right.
which used to be Charlie Chaplin's right. studio. All this history, and right. that's what the Daft Punk guys are. They're very into like the spirituality of the energy right. of places. So,
have they ever met Ian McKaig? Have they ever?
They
sounds
should.
Like a feng shui.
No, you know. Yeah, they should meet them. But I saw the spiritual connection between them and Julian.
Right.
And so I introduced them eventually. Yeah, no. So I met up with them. Also, We Are the World was recorded. Yeah. That documentary is amazing.
Yeah, that is great.
In that studio space. And that's where I first heard. In that studio is where I first heard Random Access Memories.
Oh, wow.
They played it for me alone, sitting in the control booth.
Yeah.
So I meet Daft Punk, and Tomas is the talkative one. He's like, you know, we grew up, Tron, the original Tron was such an inspiration to us as kids. It's one of our favorites. You know, we love the new movie. It's, you know, very futuristic and an updated version of Tron. But we want our music video to be a throwback to right. the old Tron. And Guiman, the other guy in Daft Punk, the gold robot, was right. eating a sandwich the whole time. I was like, this guy's not talking to me. And he finally finishes his sandwich at the end and he goes, the glow you put on Mark Ronson's shoe, once we saw that, we knew you were our guy.
Wow.
just that little detail on the shoe of Mark Ronson's foot. And then, yeah, so did the video for Tron, derezzed. Mm-hmm. And then they called me back to work on Random Access Memories.
Right.
And that was film school number two, like where they were working on this album. Maybe it was a reaction to doing this digital world of Tron. They wanted to go super analog.
Right.
So they got all of the musicians from like Thriller, you know, Paul Jackson Jr., drummer Omar Hakim, all these like old school people that played on all your favorite like 70s, 80s records were playing live instruments on that. And so that carried over to the visuals. Mm-hmm. So they were like, we want an analog feel to the visuals. Mm-hmm. We want cursive for the Random Access Memories. Come up with a logo for Random Access Memories. And warn, we don't want you to use a pen tablet on the computer. We want you to do it on paper and show us the paper. So I have a whole ream of paper where I wrote Random Access Memories over and over. Because I could do a pretty cursive thing.
Sure.
I don't normally write very nice. So I have to like do it over and over and over again. So I did random, 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 turn the page, random, random. Right. And then I circled the best ones, stuck them together, showed it to them. Like, great. Like, he actually did it with a Sharpie.
Right.
And then, so yeah. So, and then.
And then do the back cover too.
Do the back cover too. No, and then so Cedric Hervé came up with this split helmet thing. Mm-hmm. So he photographed, he's a creative director. So Cedric Hervé photographed the helmets. And he wanted to use this for like merchandise, like a t-shirt. And then it ended up being the cover. So with the split screen on the split helmets on the cover, you kind of like touched it and gave it more of an airbrush look. But when it came time to do like the visuals, the ads, the moving images, mm-hmm. They went completely analog. And so they invite me over to one of their film test days, mm-hmm. and they've got my logo printed out on black acetate. And the negative space is cut out, so Random Access Memories is clear and the rest is black. They're shining a light through it. They've got 65 millimeter film mm-hmm. on a dolly track going in an arc. And it rotates around. I'm like, and they got smoke and I'm like, why are they doing all this? Is a whole film crew filming the logo? Mm-hmm. I'm like, we could do this in After Effects, you know, like just you know, and then we go to Photochem in Burbank and watch the dailies, and the light starts shining through the logo, and it's mind-blowing. There's like weird rainbow colors and weird chromatic aberrations right. through the lens. The full spectrum of colors are like shining through this in a very strange organic way, mm-hmm. and it's magic. It's like, this is the magic of film.
Yeah.
And they actually did a side-by-side test. They shot it digitally, and then they shot it on film to compare it.
Right.
And the film version is completely monochrome. It's like cyan. And then the digital version,
right.
monochrome. And then the film has these weird imperfections in color that appear. So after that, like, I think Tomas wanted to prove that film was the way to go. So we shot everything on 60 millimeter film. Get Lucky, Lose Yourself to Dance are all 65 millimeter film. And then Instant Crush is shot on 35. Mm-hmm. And so Instant, I know I'm rambling on, but Crush was
If there's an album to ramble about, I think
it's this one, yeah. So Instant Crush was so fun because it was like they, you know, we co-directed everything together with everybody, like Guiman Tomas, Cedric, and Paul Hahn, the manager. We all kind of group directed Get Lucky and Lose Yourself to Dance. Instant Crush was sort of my baby because I had introduced Julian and and Daft Punk together. So Tomas said, "You, this is yours." And so I came up with this idea of sort of based off the Steadfast Tin Soldier, because when I was a kid, I saw an old film where the ballerina and the soldier melt in a fire into a heart together, and that emotionally stuck with me. And I was like, something very bittersweet about the song. It's like this yin and yang of like, they're finally together, it's a happy ending, but they're also dying together, you know, into this fire. And that the lyrics have that feeling. It's like this kind of push and pull between like, you know, a bittersweetness to it. And I said, okay, let's do that for the video. And so they let me go, they insisted again, go full analog. We're gonna build wax figures and really melt it on set. So like, you know, we see the faces melting at the end. That's us standing around with hair dryers all a few inches off screen, blowing the hair dryers and melting. It took like half an hour to melt it, but we speed it up. And real flames. And the guy that built the mannequins is this guy named Tony Gardner, who worked on Thriller.
Oh, he's huge, yeah.
Yeah, Ulterior Inc. He did the first Daft Punk helmets. He built the first ones. So think it, because he's such a like humble, nice guy. And also strangely looks like he's still 30 years old. But I'm like, you worked on Thriller? Were we like negative 5 years old? Right. But see, he did the Chucky kind of thing for Technologic. And so it was an honor to get to work with him on Instant Crush. So we got to do things the old-fashioned way.
It's crazy. Yeah. And I mean, you are here at South By right now for your latest collaboration.
The final Daft Punk video, the final collaboration, which is an honor too, because like it's also the Julian Daft Punk connection. So. Yeah, there was just a certain DNA that connected everybody. Like, you know, I did the Tron video, and then I'm having dinner with Julian and his manager a few weeks later after the Tron video, and he's like, "What was it like working with them? Did you see them without their helmets?" That's the first question everybody asks. And I was like, "Yeah, they're really cool dudes." He's like, "There's this song called Veritas Quo that is like one of my favorite all-time songs. It's like, it just makes me want to like go on a night drive and cry." And I was like, and I played it. I'm like, oh yeah, this is that. It's like this hypnotic loop of a song with very powerful chords, like kind of Baroque classical. And it there's a sadness to it. And so Julian is finally meets them. I'm like, "Do you think you'd want to meet them?" And then I tell the manager, and the manager tells Guiman and Tomas, they're like, "No one writes better guitar solos than Julian Casablancas." And I was like, okay, cool. So there's a connection there. And actually, I found out later, they were in a punk band called Darlin'.
Okay.
And their first show after they performed it was in one of the guys from Phoenix, the band, French band Phoenix, was also in Darlin'. Their first review said, "This is Daft Punk." And so that became their name.
That's cool.
So, but when they first saw the Strokes, apparently, Guiman was like, "That's what we were trying to do," but they did it so well. And so, you know, they connect with each other. Julian, he says, "Dude, thank you so much for introducing me to Daft Punk. They played me a demo of a song called Summer Crush," and it has that kind of like powerful, happy, sad thing that I love.
Right.
And then I didn't hear the song until weeks later. He was recording some extra vocals, so we go to Electric Lady, the famous Electric Lady Studios in New York, and I sit there, and he's doing some like vocal layovers, and then they play the chorus, and I'm like, "Fuck, this is my jam! This sounds like this makes me feel like a kid again." The chorus. So, yeah, it just felt like this like kind of synchronicity and connection of things I was meant to be in a way.
Yeah. It is I mean, not to belabor, but it is like that when Random Access Memories came out, it is kind of like a magical moment. Like it's such a standout thing. And obviously you don't need to be told that because it is like it is. Although it's funny that we're here. I don't. Did you ever? There used to be rumors every year. I've been to South by for 15 years. Every year there's a rumor that Daft Punk is going to play at the Capitol. There's always the rumor, the steps of the Capitol. And when Random Access Memories came out, there were billboards, there was like big signage everywhere for it. And I was like, this is the year that Daft
Punk. Yeah. Because I'm close to the team, the management, the creative director, we just kind of laugh at those things. We just, you know.
Every year.
Like every, you know, they'll people will forward stuff to us. Is this true? Is this true?
And like, no. No. Well, technically, they're playing this year because they're playing in the music video showcase with your video. So I guess to close out, because you've been so generous with your time, but it is your vision and your drive and how you kind of set up things runs concurrently, right? We can talk about your art. We can talk about your directing. And it's all very cohesive, right? Like, there's a Warren Fu playlist on YouTube of the music videos. Like, okay, like you can see a general through line of the little inspirations. There's the is it California Roll Snoop Dogg? It was like kind of Star Tours-y, right? It's kind of a fun, almost like puzzle pieces of your career and your creativity and your inspirations. And I guess on that creative side, you're constantly having to put out work and you're working. How do you refill the creative well? How are you drawing? What are you trying to draw from, I guess, now? Because, I mean, you have Gotcha Man.
I think this is why I'm at South By this year, too, is you know, not just to show our thing, but is to be inspired.
Right.
And I just watched this film last night called Didi, which means little brother, and it was like almost a recreation of my childhood. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's about a Taiwanese-American kid who's trying to, like, it's coming of age, he's trying to fit in. He gravitates towards these cool kids, these skateboarders, which was me gravitating towards like graffiti kids and trying to like be down with the cool kids and just trying to figure out, you know, kind of progressing and growing up in that way. And that was so inspiring. And so I'm trying to like, I'm here for a few more days and I'm trying to like fill that well of inspiration. Yeah. It's you know, there's a through line, but I'm also just kind of like a schizophrenic. I jump around. I like so many things. I like doing comedy. I love kind of scary horror stuff. You know, just being at a film festival like this is just watching shorts and watching features of all different genres. I'm trying to get into Civil War, Alex Garland's film. I didn't get in. I think I'm just trying to like watch as many people's work as possible to just sort of stay inspired.
I have one final kind of stupid question, which is in the Visionaries comic book.
Yeah.
Because the story, if people listening have not picked up, it's hard to find now, but they got the art department, the ILM art department, did their own, like we were talking about earlier with the Norman Rockwell, like you were able to tell a story. Mm-hmm. Through comic, you told a Grievous story, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is beautiful, but you also have a cameo, right? You have a small. You are Sifo Dyas. I assume that's you. Looking at you here, and I was like, okay, yeah. I saw that rumor, and I was like, let me see him in person before.
I didn't think people would pick up on it because it's so tiny, and I threw a goatee on, and I can't. I literally cannot grow a goatee.
Sure.
So I didn't think people would pick up on it, but I just kind of threw it in there as like a wait, because I looked it up, and I was like. Is there any description of this character? Right. And there isn't. Right. I'm like, well, what does he look like? And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to throw myself in there as a little cameo. And I didn't think people were going to pick up on it. And then somebody finally did. And then there were a few other like drawings that came out.
Right.
One of them looks like me still. And then like it evolved into somebody else.
Right.
So
it was for a while.
Yeah.
You were Sifo Dyas.
Yeah.
I
don't know if this is not canon though.
No. These were. But did you come up with the general idea, like him as an alien? That design. Because that has stuck.
That
like,
stuck. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like the alien looking Grievous is a.
I think the only thing I could dig up when before we started this was that he is Kalish. And I didn't come up with that.
Right.
That was already given to me. They said, he's Kalish. And I was like, what is that?
Sure.
And then I was like, okay. That design was sort of like a Boba Fett inspired from the skull thing. So I was like, what if the original tribe hunted these creatures and mm-hmm. wore them like as a ceremonial almost kind of or a battle mask.
Right.
And they would paint like the crow,
right.
you know, a little war paint on top of this mask. Right. And so when he became the Grievous, it's sort of an echo of that same shape.
It's I brought this because it like stuck. I had this is my copy from when I was, mm-hmm. you know, like I remember, and it's the last story in the book, mm-hmm. and I was like, holy shit, like yeah. this is so cool.
But I think they used some of it in like one of the cartoons.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. No, like, it is a like that does not just exist here. Like that whole thing,
the mask has
carried through.
No, that's amazing. I that's just kind of the power of Star Wars is yeah. like some little sketch is now, you know, for our spaceship, the Jedi Vector thing that I thought was going to be lost forever.
Yeah.
Is now like in a kid's show.
Yeah. You know? Well, so that was that for Attack of the Clones or for Revenge of the Sith? The clone ship or whatever?
It was supposed to be in the opening battle.
Okay. Oh, for Revenge of the Sith. Yeah. Because yes, for those, it is not just, it is in the kid's show, but it is like the X-Wing of this whole It's called the High Republic. It's a whole publishing initiative from Star Wars. It's video games and books and comics and everything. And that is like the ship, and they're making toys of it now. Like it is.
That's a dream come true because like I was inspired by the X-Wing, and the X-Wing was my favorite as a kid. You know, so yeah. It's wow.
Cool. We'll see. I mean, because also the new show, The Acolyte, that's coming out this fall or this summer, is in the High Republic, in the later age of the High Republic. So we haven't seen anything of it, but it could.
Hopefully, I would love to see it flying around.
Yeah,
I would love to see a mini set built where they sit inside of it. Right. That'd be amazing.
Well, cool, Warren. Thank you for your time. This was incredible. What a
nice. It's so fun to talk to you.
Thank you so much again to Warren for his time and flexibility while he was in Austin and allowing me to come to his hotel armed with art books and action figures for reference. A huge thank you as well to Lee Wei from Partisan for helping coordinate this, and an extra huge thanks to guest producer Alyssa Vidalis, who absolutely crushed it and helped make this recording go super smoothly. That's all for now. Until next episode, stay tuned, leave a 5-star review, and may the Force be with you.